Okay, well, what a wonderful welcome. And I'm just feeling very humbled and grateful that you actually think I can tell you something about contemplation. Because I think, knowing this group, I've only been involved since probably last year. Sadly, I didn't know about you for the last 40 years. But what an amazing group of people, and you are all on this path of evolution. So I'm just going to try to be a little bit humble today and give you some of my thoughts on Mirabai's chapter, although I'm really going to go beyond that. When Mirabai was here, we had a lovely conversation, and she gave me the wonderful offering when she found out that I was going to do this chapter that she would help me figure out how I could present it. So she went home, and then she contacted me again, and she said, you know, I've been thinking, and it would probably be better if you just told your own story. So with your permission, I'm going to make myself vulnerable today, and I'm going to talk a little bit about my journey into this vast sea of love and mercy, and perhaps my path of contemplation that continues today. And I'm just really thrilled today to see some folks that I just wanted to acknowledge. My husband is here. But also sitting next to him is a dear friend who's in our wisdom school, but Frieda Iverson has just become commissioned to offer centering prayer training. And then I have two priests. I go to two churches, Trinity and St. Mark's. And Randall Day is here as well. And he is in the first year of the Living School with Richard Rohr. I'm in the second year. So we have this wonderful, joyful journey that we can share together. So anyway, what we're going to do is begin with a chant. And Christine has offered her presence to bring back something I believe you used to do a long time ago. So we're going to start this familiar chant to bring us into the spaciousness of wholeness so we can hear these words.
Please join in as soon as you understand how this works. And please join in when you remember how we did this. And if you do hear it, it's not. If you do hear it on a different note, please sing it on a different note. Be still and know that I am God. Be still and know that I am. Be still and know. Be still. Be still and know that I am God. Be still and know that I am. Be still and know. Be still. Be still and know that I am God. Be still and know that I am. Be still and know. Be still.
I think it's very apropos that we start off with that chant. Those of you that know where this comes from, the Psalms, it's really speaking to the root, the Hebrew verb rafah, and it means to be weak, to let go, to release, abandon, forsake, stop striving. And we surrender in order to know that God is in control. The root of prayer is silence. And I think we all agree with this, and that's why we're here today. And this is where we meet God. Grace is offered in the moments between our mental agitation. But this isn't an easy task. When you welcome emptiness, there is a space that you allow for the alchemy of this spiritual transformation to take place. And I'm going to try today to share with you a little bit of the how of contemplation, and many of you are already on this path and perhaps have been a lot longer than I have. But I'm also going to attempt to tell you why we practice this. And this comes out of my own personal experience, so it's only my truth, and you may have many other truths, and I hope you share them. So I find contemplation isn't just about sitting and praying and meditating, but there are many other ways to still our mind, to get us out of that chatter of our left brain. And I find that poetry, music, art, and even, as Pat mentioned, sitting on a horse in harmony. My son says he soul surfs. So there are many, many ways to move into that space of non-thinking and opening that spaciousness to welcome God. And I have been working for a number of years with a dear teacher of mine, maybe some of you know, Fariba Entashari. I hope she speaks someday to you. She's a fabulous scholar of the Rumi tradition. And I find that poetry is really a wonderful way to allow us to find this journey to the beloved. So I'm going to reference a little bit of Rumi throughout my talk today. And I'm finding this path is really wonderful in terms of thinking about the fruits of contemplation. So I'm going to start with my very favorite Rumi quote. I actually read this at my mother's funeral. Out beyond the ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. When the soul lies down in the grass, the world is too full to talk about. Ideas, language, even the phrase each other doesn't make sense. Where is this place and how do we arrive? So I thought I would start with bits of my own personal journey as we explore this contemplative path. And as the chapter noted, and I'm not going to refer very much to the chapter because it was so clear and so wonderfully written, but this path of contemplation, meditation, is common to all the spiritual traditions at their core. And as we move into this, we are exploring the field beyond our dualistic minds. So, here's my story, or a little bit of my story. My first remembered encounter with the felt presence of the divine when I was about 9 years old. I'd experienced a rather rocky childhood due to a very difficult bout with polio and at the same time the lung disease histoplasmosis. I had hospitalizations, surgeries, blood tests, and I was isolated and in bed for nearly a year with no contact other than my mother. I remember the worried looks on my mother's face and the priests that came to bless me. And they prayed for me because the doctors had told them that I was terminal. I had no idea. I was a child. And all I cared about was getting lost in the books that I read. My world was books. And what I did, I read every book I could about horses and shaping the wondrous stories of horses out of clay. And I brought some books today that have been meaningful to me in my life. And I'm just going to share one little book. My first encounter with the pull of intuition and knowing was when I opened up this little book. You may have seen it. It's called Angel Unaware. And it was written by Dale Evans, who is my heroine. And I read this book. And do any of you know about this book? It's about her childhood, or her child named Robin. She was born with Down syndrome, and she only lived 3 years. But in those 3 years, she discovered that this child was a gift from beyond, an angel unaware. Now, I was 8 years old, nine years old at the time, and I read those words, and I went, oh, my gosh, there are angels. And I'm going to spend my life working with these angels. And I did. I did. Of course, I didn't know I was supposed to die. But anyway, I didn't, obviously. So one night, I looked out my window. It was the only place I had to see the outer world, my only contact with the outer world. And I experienced the most extraordinary shift in my awareness that stayed with me my entire life. Gazing out this window, I was amazed at the beauty of the full moon peeking in and out of the lustrous clouds. Suddenly, the image became alive and shimmered and glowed, and time stopped, and my body was filled with a warm radiance, giving me a sense of complete connection to everything. I was only 8. I became this beautiful moon. Even now, I can drop spontaneously into this wondrous state for a few moments. And then I drop back into my ordinary state of doctors and needles and loneliness. My mother was distraught. She didn't think I was going to live. So one Sunday night, she slipped into a church, into an empty pew, and she implored God to release me. This is where I always tear up. Her profound surrender changed the course of my life. The next day, when I had my weekly slew of tests, the doctor came to her with great puzzlement, and he said, "We can't find any trace of illness in her body." Who knew? So I was cured. I went back to school. I'd skipped a grade, but oh well, I had tutors. That helped. But I went back to my ordinary life as a child and a student, falling asleep again until probably my 30s. When I followed my second strong intuition, picked up stakes with my dear husband, said, "Okay, fine." I bought a house in Santa Barbara, got a job with the county schools. I said, "Bring the two babies out here when you get a job." And we came to Santa Barbara. And this is where I was so privileged to meet, I think, the folks I was destined to meet. One of them is sitting here today, my dear, dear Pat. And another one, well, several of them were here. And that, those are other stories. But my stories continue. And to my great, great gratitude, I've had many, many such encounters with the divine and the mystical sense of wholeness and time stopping on a regular basis. So what I would like to do for just a moment, I'm sure all of you can tell stories, I hope you can, of moments where you experience awe, wonder, stepping out of time, a sense of connection with one another and all, and a sense of peace. And I call these moments simple tastes of the divine. Gives us a glimpse of that deep longing to find that state of presence, or as one of my dear friends in the Living School said, stepping into the flow of God's love. So I would like you to pair up for about 10 minutes at the most and share with one another an experience that you have had in your life of this divine encounter. Okay? So just choose a partner. Oh. oh, how I wish I could have been a little bird and heard all those stories. We all have these moments. These are perhaps what we call grace. These moments of this divine encounter. We are born for this state and presence. And I think we have to recognize that this is just God's gesture of welcoming us. Listen, listen, listen. And in silence, we can deepen this. We can practice our contemplation so that these events, these encounters, become more and more and more. Until perhaps we can pray without ceasing. Because it really is a prayer when you have those moments of divine encounter. So, I'm going to talk a little bit about how. And I always overplan by about 2 hours. So I was a professor, and I was used to speaking for 3 hours at a time. So I hope you don't have any lunch plans. But anyway, moving into a little bit more about the meditation and contemplation, just a little more didactic approach, Ken Wilber, who's one of the folks that we've been studying in the Living School, and many of you may know him, perennial philosopher living still. He talks about the two major functions of religion. The first is to create meaning. And this is to make sense of our life, what our misfortunes mean, or perhaps our abundances, the prosperity gospel you've heard of. To feel a sense of belonging. It defends, it protects, it consoles the separate self. But it doesn't change the level of consciousness. And I would say perhaps the majority of religions today are of this nature. They are on what we call a horizontal plane. They allow us just to keep trucking along in our lives and to feel that we have some meaning in our lives. But that's not why we're here today. We're here to talk about that second function of religion, that only a small minority, and I suspect many of you, most of you in this room, because you're here, have reached this state or are on your way. And the early mystics in all the traditions have spoke of this. And the modern mystics, Richard Rohr, we've talked about him a lot in this group, Cynthia Bourgeau, Jim Finley, Thomas Keating, Thomas Merton, and many, many others. These are our wonderful gifts of the modern mystics. And so I believe that this is really the intention of our faith traditions, to transform our state of consciousness so that we can begin to satisfy that longing for union with the divine. Now, few of us intentionally choose this path. It's not easy. It's often very painful. That small false self, our ego self, has a pretty mighty hold on our dualistic consciousness. But this path involves emptying, you've heard the term kenosis, descent, letting go, and really transforming our consciousness at the deepest level. Now, it may become a very dramatic conversion, like Paul. Or some of you may have read a bit of Eckhart Tolle's work, The Power of Now. I believe he was sitting on a park bench and had that kind of conversion. This is rare. I don't recommend waiting around. Maybe some of you have had that, but it's not worked for me. And also, if you do jump into this, and those I know folks actually who have had these conversions, we run the risk of what I call spiritual bypass. Now, I'm a psychologist, so I believe very strongly that we have to heal those parts of ourselves, the unhealed parts of our small false self ego, before we can truly transform. And when we jump ahead into this state of awe and transformation, we may miss that point and really not truly be healed. However, most of us find that we may have a radical, intentional, or unintentional practice of being stripped bare by tragedy, grief, illness. And then there are those of us who maybe don't have these kinds of events in their lives. I'm not sure I know anybody that doesn't. I certainly have my number of dark nights. But we can also move this practice along a bit by a radical, intentional practice of what we call kenosis, or letting go. And how do we do that? Through contemplation. And practicing, sitting, holding the space. This path of letting go undercuts our whole center of our ego that holds us together. And it throws us into a sense of feeling unmoored. Where am I? I don't have anything to hold on to. And as we dive into this place of unknowing, we have to find a new center of spaciousness that is open to allow us to move into our larger true self. So how do you know if you're in your false self? How do you know? Well, I found personally that there's a body sensation that I can tune into when I start to go into that false self, which I do 100 times a day. You become defensive, contracted, fearful, judgmental. You can feel it in your body just pulling inward. Have any of you ever felt that way? When somebody says something that's hurtful, you pull in. When you're fearful, you pull in. We contract into that. It's almost like a primitive state of protection. It's a visceral kind of thing. And this comes with your identification with the dual nature of your false small self and that calculating egocentric mind that we have. So we need to strip ourselves naked and bare and transcend our senses and constructs. So I'm here to speak to Mirabai's chapter, but I come from a tradition of Christianity, so that's my frame of reference. In order to become what I call an intentional, transformed Christian, or Jew, or Muslim, or Buddhist, whatever, or someone who's seeking sobriety, we have to sit for a time in this confusion, and it's really uncomfortable. We have to feel unrooted until a new way of seeing and being is discovered. Out of this transformation comes the gesture of commitment to alleviate the suffering of the world. Now, we all feel the impulse to help others, don't we? I know everybody in this room has a wonderful ministry in the world. All of you, I know that. But it's important to know that you come from a transformed place in order to do and alleviate that suffering. If you don't, you're coming from an egoic state, and perhaps your motives aren't as pure as you would hope them to be. And I've been doing some of my own internal discernment with some activities that I've been involved with for a very long time. And I realized that many of my actions come from that egoic base. I want to feel community. I want to feel appreciated. I want to feel good about myself. But that's coming from my small self. So it's really, really important to come from that transformed state of non-dual consciousness. Not easy. We still need to do these good works, but it's really wonderful when you can come from that transformed state. So what is contemplation after all? Now, I believe it's seen from this deeper place, that field that Rumi talked about, where we meet each other without judgment, evaluation. Thomas Keating has given a pretty good definition of contemplative prayer. It's a process of interior transformation, a conversion initiated by God and leading, if we consent, to divine union. One's way of seeing reality changes in this process. A restructuring of consciousness takes place, which empowers one to perceive, relate, and respond to everyday life with increasing sensitivity to the divine presence which is within, through and beyond everything that happens. So it's not just about sitting in mindfulness or seizan or centering prayer, it's much more. That's merely the doorway into this process. It's about creating a spaciousness and a receptivity that invites this ongoing encounter with the divine presence. It involves, first of all, attention. Gotta start with attention. And that's where mindfulness comes in. Mindfulness is a very different state than centering prayer, but it allows us to attend. And then intention, which I think centering prayer, the intention to surrender and to offer that space. But it doesn't have to be necessarily formal sitting. We can offer ourselves to the present moment and be alert to signs of self in a sacred breaking through everywhere. At this very moment, you can be sitting in contemplation. Those spaces that you talked about of awe in your little encounter, in your little dyads that you had a moment ago, those were moments of contemplation, of spaciousness, of offering that place for the divine to encounter you. So this divine spark is in every moment, every part of creation, and it appears in the most mundane of tasks. It's the primordial language of God, who lives in emptiness in love. It's the space between our thoughts. And we can talk about these terms, cataphatic, which means words, praying with words, or apophatic, which is really praying without words, the notion that I'm listening to God's presence. It's a different way of seeing. Julian of Norwich, some of you may have a fondness for that particular mystic. She talks about contemplative prayer is to recognize, and this is very interesting, that language is an agent of control. Who knew? During her 3 days of near death, she was stripped of language and her self-identity, totally stripped, almost of life itself. And she had these apparitions or mystical teachings that came to her. And she spent the rest of her life trying to explain how to know herself as nothing. Prayer is a summons to silence, and we admit that we're naked before God. And I love this word that came out of it. The words are the fig leaves we grasped to hide our nakedness. If we can name it, we think we can control it. Control is power, and power is safety. And what self needs safety? Small self. So apophatic or contemplative prayer invites us to vulnerability stripped of the support of words. So there's basically three kinds of meditation, and I'm going to skip a lot of what I planned, but just to kind of touch on, we have the concentration type of meditation, which is focused, calming, relaxing, a mantra, saying a word over and over it with a vibration that calms the mind. And this is really a Zen approach. And I've tried them all. I've spent time at Upaya down in New Mexico with Roshi, Joan Halifax. And it's a wonderful Seizan practice. It anchors us, whole body, in the here and now. But it doesn't unload the unconsciousness. Mindfulness. I know you've had many presentations on mindfulness. I'm also trained in mindfulness with Jon Kabat-Zinn, and I practice that periodically. It is an open awareness, totally the opposite. It allows for us to look at various stimuli that come in, thoughts, perceptions, to notice, let go. And then we return back to the breath, and it allows us to have a more attentive, awake state. So it brings us to attention. And it may evoke a sense of aliveness and unity and take in everything without clinging. But again, and again, my bias is to Christianity, but I feel like it doesn't help us unload those unconscious programs that we have a lifetime of. And then we have the receptive kind of contemplation. And this is centering prayer. And I'm not even going to spend a lot of time because we have the experts here in the room. But this allows us to withdraw the external reality from our external senses, letting go, kenosis, constant, letting go, unloading. And it loosens up this emotional garbage that may come up. And it's a means to establish the unity of the body, the mind, and the spirit, and tap into that river of love, that source of being. And this form of contemplation is a more dreamy state. These are all very different brain states. I could talk as a neuropsychologist about how the brain is affected and all of that. Boring. We aren't going to do that. But it does bring us into a very, very different state. The use of the sacred word, it's not really the point, but it allows us to let go and dissolve our thoughts, our perceptions. It affirms our attention to surrender to this mystery of the divine presence. And it allows that junk, that psychological jump, to come up. And we can stop this inner dialogue. So it's probably a preferred approach that I have developed, but I go back and forth with all of them as well. Now, I think going back to Mirabai's chapter, one of the things that I picked up from the essence of it is that the royal road to this state of consciousness in all the traditions is through the breath, and it draws us into the now. And I'm just going to give a little roomy quote at this point, because I think it's apropos to what she was talking about. Not Christian or Jew or Muslim, not Hindu, Buddhist, Sufi or Zen, not any religion or cultural system. I am not from the east or the west, nor out of the ocean or up, from the ground, not natural or ethereal, not composed of elements at all. I do not exist, am not an entity in this world or in the next, did not descend from Adam and Eve or any origin story. My place is placeless, a trace of the traceless, neither body or soul. I belong to the beloved, have seen the two worlds as one, and that one call to and know, first, last, outer, inner, only that breath, breathing, human being. So we could say that our first and our last spoken word is the name of God. In the ancient Jewish tradition, Yahweh is the name of God. Now think about this. Yahweh. Yahweh. The in-breath and the out-breath. If we attend to our breath consciously, with our whole body, we are speaking the name of God with every breath. So let's just take a moment and consciously become aware of this. We're going to take three contemplative breaths. Settle in your body. Be fully present to your body. Becoming aware of how it feels, the sensations, and your breath. Focus on the in-breath. Yeah. And the out-breath. Way. Yeah. Way. Yeah. Way. So just know that every time you take a breath, you are speaking the name of God. And I have to mention here that all of these faith traditions have so much in common. They all address the notion of deep, deep presence, which leads us into transformation. And I think now in Christianity in particular, we are reclaiming this particular stance, which has always been there. But we forgot, perhaps for many centuries. The early desert mothers and fathers knew this. They went out into the desert. The disciples knew this. And now we've come back into this. And I remember a number of years ago, part of my entry and reawakening a number of about 30 years ago, I believe, I've lost track of time, 35, my children had an opportunity to make a movie with the Dalai Lama. And he was here in Santa Barbara, so I spent a day with His Holiness. And I had the opportunity to ask him, because I was disillusioned. I just had left. I went to church, and I came away feeling flat. And I asked him, I said, so many people, Christians in particular, and Jewish folks, are going to the East for their renewal, to find contemplation, to find meditation. Why? And he looked at me and he said, you chose this incarnation. Go back to your tradition. There are many ways to the same center. And so I went back. And I think, you know, it was such a gift to know that it was already there in my tradition. And the breath is the anchor that ties all of us together. So how does this work? I know I'm getting a little bit over time here, but I think it's important to recognize that we are biologically wired to transform. And Cynthia Bourgeau is one of our teachers, many of us in this room, and she talks about how we are born from an undifferentiated consciousness as babies. We don't know that we're separate. And then we begin at about 7 months of age to move into that dualistic mind because we need to. We need an ego. We need to know that we are separate so that we can survive in this incarnation, on this earth, in what we call this horizontal plane. The vertical is really our spiritual transformation, but we've got to survive in these bodies. And so this ego development is really important. And we don't want to lose our egos. We just don't want to have it control us. But finally, the highest level of integration is this non-dual consciousness, where we no longer divide the world into subject, object, inside, outside, you, me, contrast, perceiving by separation. So I think it's really important to recognize that there is a trajectory that we are all upon, and some of you know about Teilhard's work in terms of the evolution of the consciousness of the universe. And we're moving toward this place, this omega point. And we aren't trying to lose ourselves or to lose our identification, but we are building a whole new body of humanity because we're all part of this divine love. And I told Dawn I was just going to mention very quickly a little story about my mother. When she was dying of Lewy body dementia, before she could no longer speak, she was in so much agony. It took 7 years for her to finally end. But she just gradually moved inward into this state of almost luminous consciousness. But at one point she said, "Why am I still here?" And I didn't know what to say. I mean, it was awful. It was agony. She was blind. She was contracted up. She couldn't move. She could barely speak. Why am I still here? I didn't know what to say. But then all of a sudden, out of my voice came an answer. And this has been the greatest gift of my life. My voice said, "You are here to become love." Wow. Isn't that what it's all about? We are here in this incarnation, on this earth, to expand and become love. We are part of this sea of mercy, this beautiful sea of love that God has provided us with. But we have to awaken. We have to open our eyes and see with new eyes in order to become love. So I thought if I can just give one more little poem, and then I wanted to take us into break with a short meditation. But I think it's important to recognize that within each of us there is this spark, this deep, deep spark of God, of divine. And Thomas Merton has talked about this as the point vierge. Many of you know what that is. Somewhere deep inside of us that we are sacred. This longing, this connection, it's like a honing beacon to God. And when we can practice this contemplation in this space of stillness, we are connected to our source. And Mirabai referenced this very, very briefly with the Rumi poet. And I don't know how many of you have been studying Rumi or maybe don't even know about Rumi, but there's a 6 books of the Journey to the Beloved. In the very first book of the Masnava, there's a song of the reed, and I just wanted to give you a little taste of that. Listen to the story of the reed flute, of being separated. Since I was cut from the reed bed, I have made this crying sound. Anyone apart from someone he loves understands what I say. I want a heart torn, torn from separation, so that I may explain the pain of yearning. Anyone who has remained far from his roots seeks a return to the time of his union. Every thirst gets satisfied except that of the fish, the mystics, who swim in a vast ocean of grace and still longing for it. No one lives in that without being nourished every day. But if someone doesn't want to hear the song of the reed flute, it's best to cut the conversation short and say goodbye. So, one of my favorite Beatitudes is, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. And to me, this is putting on the mind of Christ, which is really seeing with the mind of the heart. So I'd like to take us out to break with a little prayer that I developed. I know Frida's heard it before, and it's what I call the prayer of the heart. And I'm going to skip half of what I was going to say because I'm not going to keep you here for 3 hours. And what I'd like to say after we finish this little meditation, I'm going to ask you to sit for a moment in silence. And I've asked Tom to just play a little meditative music so that you feel free to just kind of sit in this sea of love and mercy that we've created in this room through our joint sharing of our conscious love and meditation. And when you feel moved so to do so, then you may go out to your break. But allow this room to just be a little space of sacred stillness for a few moments. So, let's begin the time of slowing down our awareness and take a few cleansing breaths, noticing the chatter in your mind. Don't try to stop or control it. Don't judge it. Just let it go. Repeating lightly in your mind the phrase, "Thy will be done," slowly over and over, surrendering into the heart of God. If your mind wanders, just notice it and come back to that phrase, "Thy will be done." Now directing your focus to an inner experience of gratitude. Think of everything you have to be grateful for at this moment, now. Bringing this sense of gratitude to your full awareness in your mind and in your heart. Continue meditating on the abundance in your life for a few moments. And now directing your focus to a silent commitment to have the intent to let go of grievances. Thinking of people and situations that may have caused you grief and anger. Seek an attitude of letting go of angry, resentful feelings for just this moment. Noticing a desire to let go of hurtful things that may trouble you. and bringing your awareness back to the phrase, "Thy will be done." As you continue to slip into this restful state, allowing your awareness to scan through your body, noticing any areas of tension, discomfort, or bracing, opening, letting go of that bracing, opening to the presence of God. Moving your awareness to your heart, allowing yourself to see through the perception of wholeness in everyone and everything, feeling the love and connection to God, bringing each breath to this awareness with your heart. Ending this simple meditation with a prayer from Mother Teresa. The fruit of silence is prayer. The fruit of prayer is faith. The fruit of faith is love. The fruit of love is service. And the fruit of service is peace.